Today is Thursday, September 16th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. forms military alliance with U.K. and Australia.
We need to be able to address both the current strategic environment in the region and how it may evolve, because the future of each of our nations, and indeed the world, depends on a free and open Indo-Pacific.
Plus, Russia holds parliamentary polls as President Putin isolates over COVID.
Analysts call these elections crucial, with the ruling United Russia Party aiming to maintain its overwhelming majority in the State Duma, the Russian parliament.
Also, world fails to meet Paris Accord goal to limit global warming. Our top story today is around the Indo-Pacific. The White House has formed a new alliance with Britain and Australia for sharing military and cyber technology for a security presence in the Indo-Pacific region. Analysts say the alliance is an effort to counter the potential threat from China. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
British officials have stressed that the pact wasn't a response to one country, but analysts believe it's an unmistakable sign of concern about China's military ambitions in the Indo-Pacific region. They've said it's highlighted the strategic importance of the region to both the United States and Britain. The new pact was announced Wednesday during a virtual joint statement President Joe Biden made, along with Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. President Biden praised the partnership.
We need to be able to address both the current strategic environment in the region and how it may evolve, because the future of each of our nations, and indeed the world, depends on a free and open Indo-Pacific enduring and flourishing in the decades ahead.
In the joint statement, the leaders said there were several potential issues of concern, including territorial disputes, terrorism, and organized crime. Analysts said the deal was significant because it allows Australia to build nuclear-powered submarines for the first time. The government in Canberra has insisted the submarines would not carry nuclear weapons. The alliance, known by its acronym AUKUS, will also cover artificial intelligence, quantum technologies, and cyber defences. Johnson said the three nations were natural allies. Morrison said the pact would boost regional security.
The future of the Indo-Pacific will impact all our futures. To meet these challenges, to help deliver the security and stability our region needs, we must now take our partnership to a new level. A partnership that seeks to engage, not to exclude, to contribute, not take, and to enable and empower, not to control or coerce. And so, friends, AUKUS is born.
However, Australia's news reports suggest the scrapping of a multi-billion dollar submarine defence deal with France will cause immense diplomatic tensions between the two nations. The deal, the Australian government says, will be scrapped because of Australia's plans to build nuclear-powered submarines under the AUKUS security pact with the US and Britain. For decades, Australia has sought security with defence and intelligence pacts. The ANZUS, another security treaty between the US, Australia and New Zealand, recently celebrated its 70th anniversary. Australia is also an active member of the Five Eyes Alliance, which includes the US, Britain, Canada and New Zealand. The Five Eyes Alliance was created to monitor the Soviet Union after the Second World War. Australian officials have said the nuclear-powered submarines would be in service in the mid to late 2030s. Adam Bandt, leader of the Greens, a minor left-of-centre party, said on Twitter that the move was dangerous and would put floating Chernobyls in the heart of Australia's cities, referring to a nuclear energy accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine in 1986. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
China's foreign ministry on Thursday decried the new US-Britain-Australia partnership, which involves helping Canberra acquire nuclear-powered submarines, saying the three countries are damaging regional peace and stability. China will closely monitor the situation, ministry spokesman Zhao Liniang said at a daily news briefing in Beijing. Under the security partnership announced by President Joe Biden, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, the United States and Britain will provide Australia with the technology and capability to deploy nuclear-powered submarines. The United States and its allies are looking for ways to push back against China's growing power and influence, particularly its military buildup, pressure on Taiwan and deployment in the contested South China Sea. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken told U.S. lawmakers the Biden administration was prioritizing evacuating Americans and Afghans working for the U.S. Agency for Global Media and the National Endowment for Democracy from Afghanistan. The effort comes as the U.S. weighs how to send millions of dollars in aid directly to Afghans and not to the de facto Taliban government. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
The de facto government of Afghanistan, the Taliban, were warned Tuesday by top U.S. lawmakers that further sanctions could be on the way. Democratic Senator Robert Menendez.
The United States and the United Nations should maintain existing sanctions on the Taliban. The U.S. should reimpose those sanctions that were waived during the negotiations process. And the U.S. should consider new measures to impose higher costs on the group and its leaders while ensuring that life-saving humanitarian aid is able to assist those most vulnerable.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken pledged that $64 million in new U.S. aid will go directly to the people of Afghanistan and not the Taliban, as he faced a second tough day of questions on Capitol Hill about the Biden administration's management of the chaotic evacuation at Kabul Airport last month.
I don't want to sugarcoat this, because we know that while the Taliban seeks and will probably support and protect basic humanitarian assistance through these agencies, like for food and medicine, it may be a different story when it comes to things that are directed specifically at women and girls. So we're going to be very focused on that and trying to make sure that that assistance can go through, that it's monitored effectively.
But the fate of thousands of SIVs, Afghan allies who assisted the U.S. and were promised special visas to leave Afghanistan, remains uncertain, with lawmakers on both sides of the aisle saying the Biden administration still has not done enough to speed up the application process. Republican Senator Jim Reich.
Not counting the SIVs that arrived before Kabul's fall, you evacuated 705 of roughly 20,000 principal SIV applicants. What happened to these people?
U.S. officials say they are still working to evacuate Americans and Afghans from the country. But the top Republican on the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee says the overall number of at-risk Afghans left behind is even larger than expected. Republican Senator Rob Portman.
We think about 30,000 at-risk Afghans were evacuated out of an estimated 60,000. That's the best numbers we can come up with, because we can't get good numbers from the administration.
After weeks of concern, Blinken did pledge to prioritize the evacuation of Afghans who worked for the U.S. Agency for Global Media and who are now in hiding in Afghanistan. Democratic Senator Chris Coons.
There's about 550 employees and family members from Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, who were not evacuated. Is the department prioritizing their evacuation?
Yes.
The U.S. and its allies evacuated 124,000 people, mostly Afghans, from the Kabul airport. Most of them between the fall of Kabul on August 15th and the last U.S. military flight out of Afghanistan on August 31st. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
With the U.S. out of Afghanistan after 20 years, some experts say China and Pakistan are stepping in to provide both immediate support and the prospects of long-term investment for the Taliban government in Kabul. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondents in the same reports on what this could mean for the region and for U.S. security interests.
Some Afghans are selling their prized possessions to finance their escape from Taliban rule or just to pay for food. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says the country is facing a humanitarian crisis.
Humanitarian aid will not solve the problem if the economy of Afghanistan collapses. And we know that the risk is enormous and that there is a dramatic lack of cash.
On Monday, the international community pledged more than $1.2 billion for humanitarian and development assistance for Afghanistan. The Taliban's acting foreign minister also called for access to the country's $10 billion in foreign assets, much of which has been frozen in the United States. Amir Khan Muttaqi is the Taliban acting foreign minister.
We believe that the USA is a big country. They need to have a big heart. Afghanistan is a poor country and must not be treated cruelly. We want positive and inclusive relations with the international community, and we ask them also to stop putting more pressure on the Afghan people.
The U.S. and other Western countries are calling on the Taliban to respect human rights, and in particular, the rights of women and girls before the assets are released. But China and Pakistan have sent food and health supplies to the Taliban acting government and held meetings with Taliban representatives. Experts say for Pakistan, the support for the Taliban is nothing new. Maximilian Hess is with the Foreign Policy Research Institute.
Pakistan certainly has had a relationship with the Taliban or individuals who constitute some of the Taliban leadership going back over 30 years.
The U.S. State Department is calling on Pakistan to hold the Taliban accountable, as Islamabad had pledged to do. State Department spokesperson Ned Price.
We are going to continue to look to Pakistan and to other countries in the region to make good on their public statements, on commitments they have made to, in different ways, step up to support the people of Afghanistan.
Another analyst points out that for Pakistan, India is always a factor in the equation. Manjari Chatterjee Miller is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
Pakistan is worried about India. India is its number one enemy. And so it definitely wants a government in Afghanistan that is friendly towards Pakistan and not towards India.
As for China, one expert says the important thing to keep an eye on is long-term investment in Afghanistan. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Russia prepares for parliamentary and local elections on Sunday in what the opposition says is an atmosphere of repression. Many candidates not aligned with the ruling party have been barred from running. John Speer narrates this report from Ricardo Makina in Moscow.
Analysts call these elections crucial, with the ruling United Russia Party aiming to maintain its overwhelming majority in the State Duma, the Russian parliament. The poll follows months of pressure against the liberal and democratic opposition in the streets and against independent media on the internet, something that has political activists deeply pessimistic. Among them is Vladimir Kara-Murza, a prominent opponent of Russian President Vladimir Putin.
It's even debatable if we can speak about the opposition in Russia. Opposition is a term that's associated with democracies. Oppositions usually sit in parliaments or in television studios, can participate in elections. In our country today, the key opponents of this regime are either dead, imprisoned or exiled.
Popular support for Putin remains notably high, with a Levada Center survey finding he has a 65% approval rating. The political struggle for seats in parliament is between Putin's party and the communists or nationalist radicals. Parties that many independent observers say are considered systemic or a facade to maintain the democratic image of the country. Anton Orek is a political analyst. We have got currently both communists, LDPR and Fair Russia in the Duma. Has Duma become a venue for discussions? No, for a long time. No, for already several sessions. Despite the pressure against candidates who are critical of the government, the only hope for the opposition is with the liberal parties, such as Yabloko, the Russian Democratic Party, and some independent candidates who have managed to participate in these elections. Political analyst Boris Kargalinsky says they remain the opposition's only voice when so many others have been silenced.
The only positive thing about elections is campaigning, because no matter how they count, and even no matter how we vote, because it doesn't count. And the important thing is that you at least can speak up.
Concerns about possible fraud are widespread. The opposition hopes for a massive turnout as the best defense against any attempts to rig the vote. Kirill Goncharov of the Yabloko party. If they try to do that, the legitimacy of the Duma will be equal to zero. That is why it is required to mobilize our supporters, despite everything. But early indications point to a low voter turnout. With few opposition candidates running and voter apathy generally high, big political changes in Russia appear to be unlikely this time around. For Ricardo Marquina in Moscow, John Speer, VOA News.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says dozens of his staff have been infected with the coronavirus and that he will continue his self-isolation because of the outbreak. The Kremlin said earlier this week that he would self-isolate after someone in his inner circle was infected Although Putin had tested negative for the virus and is fully vaccinated with Russia's Sputnik V, but Putin on Thursday said the infections were extensive. This is the Voice of America. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte's top legal advisor has lashed out at the International Criminal Court's decision to investigate allegations of crimes against humanity during his bloody war on drugs. Chief Presidential Legal Counsel Salvador Panelo alleged Thursday that the Netherlands-based International Court was, quote, being utilized as a political and propaganda apparatus, unquote, by Duterte's political opponents as the country prepares for election. Duterte's spokesman said the president vows, quote, he'll die first before he faces any international courts, unquote. Somalia's President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo says he has suspended the powers of Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Robo. The president accused the prime minister of not having a working relationship with him and said he made rash decisions. The two men recently disagreed over the case of a missing intelligence officer. The National Intelligence Agency says Al-Shabaab militants killed the officer after she went missing in June. The militant group has denied the accusation. Robo assigned a military court to investigate the case and appointed a new director for the intelligence agency, only for the president to reject the move. The prime minister has not immediately responded to the president's announcement. A source close to him told VOA's Somali service that Robo will share his views with the Somali people, quote, soon, unquote. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Scientists from several organizations that monitor and assess the state of the Earth's climate system warn the world is not on track to meet the target of a Paris Agreement to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2050. The United in Science 2021 report provides a compilation of the latest climate science. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The report warns greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere are continuing at record levels, committing the planet to dangerous future warming. It notes the last five-year period has been the warmest since record-keeping began in 1850. Scientists say rising temperatures due to human activity are causing higher-than-average temperatures in the Arctic, Europe, and Asia. They are increasing the frequency and intensity of floods, droughts, wildfires, storms, and other extreme weather events throughout the world. Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, Petteri Talas, says weather events that used to happen every 100 years now are happening every 20 years because of climate change. He warns they will occur with even greater frequency in the future if the world does not limit warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius by mid-century.
Now we are heading towards 2 to 3 degrees warming instead of 1.5 to 2 degrees, and it has been shown clearly that would be beneficial for the welfare of us human beings and the welfare of the biosphere and the planet to reach even the low limit of Paris Agreement 1.5 degrees.
The report notes that COVID-19 has had no impact on climate change. It says pandemic lockdowns and economic slowdowns reduced air pollution for a time and was beneficial for human health. However, this was only temporary. Now that societies are opening again, it says carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere are growing. Talas says mitigation measures can reduce the release of greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere and reduce climate change. But for this to happen, he says people must change their daily behavior.
If we fail with the climate mitigation, we would have a permanent problem for at least hundreds or even thousands of years, and both the economic and human well-being effects would be much more dramatic than this COVID pandemic, which has been hitting us all in a dramatic way.
In a foreword to the United in Science report, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warns time is running out. He says all countries must commit to net zero emissions by 2050, backed up by concrete long-term strategies to prevent further irreversible damage. He says these pledges must be made now for November's UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow to be a turning point in the fight for the survival of the planet. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
High-level African officials met virtually this week to discuss the challenges Africa faces in trying to manage a growing population amid climate change. The conference was aimed at identifying ways African governments can manage these pressures to minimize or avoid conflict. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Africa generates about 3% of global greenhouse gas emissions, the lowest of any continent, but it is more vulnerable than any other region in the world, since Africans depend so heavily on their natural environment for food, water and medicine. Speaking at a virtual conference Tuesday on climate, conflict and demographics in Africa, Nigerian Vice President Yemi Osinbajo said African governments need to keep the climate in mind as they try to boost their economies.
Our first obligation for us and for African countries must always be to ensure the well-being of our people through access to development services, including electricity, healthcare, education, safe jobs and a safe environment, including access to clean cooking fuels. We must prioritize solutions that align the development and climate agendas, and that is absolutely important.
The Center for Research on the Epidemiology of Disasters, based in Brussels, says that in 2019, Africa recorded 56 extreme weather events compared to 45 in the previous year. The extreme weather patterns affected the lives of 16.6 million people in 29 countries. At least 13 million of them were from five countries: Kenya, Mozambique, Somalia, Tanzania, and Zimbabwe. West Africa had fewer weather-related catastrophes, but is feeling the effects of global warming just the same. Kwaku Ifirie is the Ghana Environment Minister. He explains how climate change has impacted agricultural lands in the country.
The harsh and deteriorating climate conditions in northern Ghana undoubtedly energize the region, growing food insecurity and the seasonal north to south migration. And besides, the increasing occurrence of floods and protracted droughts leads to displacement of people. Statistics show that over the last few years, there's been a new internal displacement which has occurred in Ghana due to climate-induced disasters and even beyond our borders.
The UN Special Representative to the African Union, Hannah Teta, says the continent needs to improve cross-border information sharing and cooperation to handle climate-related crises. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Iceland is now the home of the world's largest direct air capture and storage plant of carbon dioxide. The plant aims to remove 4,000 tons of carbon dioxide, one of the main contributors to global warming, from the air each year, as VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
The world's largest plant capturing carbon dioxide directly from the air is now operating in Iceland. The plant was built by Climeworks, a Swiss firm, using technology from another Icelandic company. Speaking with Reuters, Jan Wurzbacher, Climeworks CEO and co-founder.
With a capacity of 4,000 tons of CO2 that are captured from the air every year, so that's the nominal capacity, and we are then handing over this CO2 to our partners from Carbfix, who inject it underground, and the CO2 there is mineralized with the basalt rock and is turned into stone, literally.
Filters in huge fans in the plant called Orca have been set up to do the job. Chemical engineer Natalie Cassas, Climeworks head of research and design, explains.
We have this box where we have a filter material inside. The filter material has a high affinity to CO2. This means when we blow air through the collector, the CO2 sticks to the filter material, and we keep on blowing air through. When the filter material is saturated, we stop, we close the box, and we start heating. We heat with low-grade heat up to approximately 100 degrees. And while doing so, the CO2 is released from the filter material and can be pumped out of the collector.
The heating process to create the high-grade carbon dioxide that is then pumped deep into basalt caverns requires energy. Cassas says this comes from a nearby geothermal power plant, a renewable energy source.
So we don't want to emit CO2 while capturing CO2. We also did a quite thorough LCA, so life cycle analysis, in order to understand how much CO2 are we emitting while capturing CO2.
Climeworks says building direct capture plants are not enough to solve the whole global warming problem. Countries will need to remove 1 billion tons of CO2 from the atmosphere by 2025 to meet Paris Climate Agreement target goals and avert catastrophic warming, according to a recent study. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedofa in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.